extent on what we're doing, which is the Stone Creek Coffee Podcast. As a reminder, I'm Drew, and I ask questions.
And I'm Christian, and I answer questions sometimes.
And we'll occasionally reverse roles, and we're always drinking something. So today we're talking about fermentation, and it's fitting to make a return to beer as our what are we tasting. And we have a special beer today to taste, which is exciting.
Yeah, we have a little homebrew from our friend Carl. Carl just started working. He just started working at Stone Creek. And yeah, he has this very nice homebrew for us. So let's taste it. Have either of us tasted it yet?
We have quite a few home tasters or home brewers here, right? Stone Creek?
Yeah, we do, and I'm about to join the ranks.
Nice. Dink it.
Thank you.
It's hoppy. Yeah, it's pretty pronounced hops.
Do you know
good
kind?
Bitterness. I do, but only because he told me. I can't identify hops based on taste.
Yeah, this hop
except for Citra. I can normally pick out Citra easy. Hops.
This hop is pretty easy for me now.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I had a half of a Fantasy Factory earlier today, and then I had to get in the car, so I stopped. So the other half is waiting for me at home. And similar kind of bitterness to a Fantasy Factory, which we've tasted on the air, piney. Other than that...
Now this has the maltiness, the sweetness is really clean. There's not a lot of residual like sugar on your palate, so it's not very heavy. It's crisp.
Delicate.
Mm-hmm.
It's light.
So this is a local beer, which is pretty cool. So all the ingredients were sourced locally within 50 miles of Milwaukee. He used Cascade hops. I think he said he did two or three infusions of the hop process.
I think he actually grows his own hops out in Oconomowoc.
He grows them in Oconomowoc from 840 rhizomes.
I don't know what that is.
I don't know. He's been doing that, so that's pretty cool. You don't see many people growing hops around here. And if you do, you're lucky to taste some of their beer. And then the malts underneath it are pale and two row. And they're from Bries, which is up in New Holstein, Wisconsin, up in my neck of the woods near Sheboygan. So pretty cool. And then the yeast in here is a pale ale yeast. So it gives that kind of light, crisp, sweet flavor.
Sweet. Good beer, Carl. Thanks, man. Definitely appreciate him bringing this to us. He didn't say we had to try it on the podcast, but I told him there's no way we would not try it on the podcast. All right, let's talk about fermentation in coffee now, having had a beer that is fermented. And we want to talk about fermentation because it's a misunderstood aspect of processing coffee. Like, if you ask any person on the street, they may not know that coffee actually is a fermented food product. In the same way that chocolate is.
Cheese.
Kimchi. Yeah, many cheeses. Kimchi.
Kimchi. Prosciutto.
Sauerkraut.
Sauerkraut.
Yep.
Beer. Alcohol.
Any kind of alcohol.
Kombucha.
Has to be fermented.
Yeah. There's a lot of fermented foods out there that we eat on a regular basis. Yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
Yogurt has a ferment in it.
Mm-hmm.
So
I thought by definition, or we should start with a definition, like what is fermentation?
Fermentation is just the conversion of some sort of sugar into some sort of other substance, depending on what kind of bacteria or yeast or medium that you use to cause that fermentation. Being from Wisconsin, it's easy for us to talk beer and drink beer. So fermentation that we see in normal beer, you know, that's a normal yeast that's going to take the sugars inside of a beer and convert that to alcohol. That's not the kind of fermentation we're doing with coffee. So you're not going to get a boozy coffee. You're not going to get that naturally bourbon-flavored coffee. Go back a couple of episodes, listen to our Bourbon Barrel podcast.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That was... Yeah.
Side note, I figured out how to do it right. We'll do that soon.
Are you sure? Because don't overpromise.
I'm not going to overpromise.
I know you're working on it. I'm pretty excited.
My brain is churning.
Did you work on it like yesterday evening?
No. Oh, no.
Okay.
I had to go home and do some stuff.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. And fermentation, when it talks about with coffee, is more similar to what you would see in a kombucha. So Drew wants to take it a little more step by step. So
yeah.
Where do you want to start?
I thought it was important in order to make it where people could track with us, because it is a really technical subject we're talking about today. And so, yeah, fermentation, like if you were to just give like a stripped down version outside of any sort of specific kind of fermentation, is almost like it is kind of decomposition. Like it's where microbial growth on a particular substance kind of starts to change, as Christian said, that substance, and it's part of, you know, the breaking down of a substance or the changing of one substance to another, as Christian said, often. In beverages, this is in reference to alcohol, or creates alcohol. So that's what fermentation is. It's microbial growth and then the changing of the particular substrate that the microbial growth is taking place on. Being that that's what fermentation is, and it's used in other foods or drinks to create alcohol or create a certain flavor profile in like a cheese, sometimes it's used to preserve things. Why is coffee fermented?
Practical purposes, actually. Or at least originally, there was no real reason to ferment coffee, except for trying to get the sticky fruit off the inside bean. You can't get it off any other way except for fermenting it. So naturally, people have easy access to water. They have pits or tanks that they have around their farm. So naturally, they throw the coffee in, throw in some water, let it sit for 24 hours, push it around a little bit, and voila, you have clean coffee. A.K.A. a washed coffee.
Which, I mean, it kind of has to be clean to get it to dry and be stable. Because when, if you've been to a coffee farm, you know that when you take the outer skin off of your coffee, you're left with mucilage on the bean. It's a sticky mess. And then when the coffee dries, even if that mucilage is left on there, it is a sticky mess until you remove the inner layer surrounding the pit called the parchment. The process of fermentation actually loosens that mucilage where you clean it off and then you can dry it evenly and it becomes stable, easier to ship, and then easier to remove the parchment so you then can roast the coffee when you're able to. And most of the time when coffee is shipped from origin, the parchment's been removed so you're just left with the pit. So they do that parchment removal stage for us, which is nice.
So when you're thinking fermentation, you usually think, again, in terms of beer, like you, if you go to a brewery, you're like, okay, here's your yeast, here's your wort, here's your boil, and then someone pitches yeast in it. You're like, when you're thinking about a coffee, it's like, wait, is someone going in and pitching yeast in there? Where's that yeast coming from? Where's that bacteria coming from? And what's interesting is it's actually coming naturally on the outside of the cherry skin. So when they pulp and they break that coffee open, it exposes that rich environment of sugar that the yeast are just going to go right after. Mm-hmm. And it really is unique in the fact that we don't know this for 100% because there hasn't been 100% research done on this yet, but I will hypothesize, and I've been hypothesizing for a little bit, that a lot of the interesting characteristics of a coffee actually comes from the yeast and bacteria located on that farm that are unique to that farm that are not available at a different farm.
All right, pause there because I want to come back to that.
Pause.
Pausing. All right, so let's talk about different kinds of fermentation in coffee before we get into really the big question, how does fermentation or how do fermentation methods affect flavor? Which I think they do, but as a larger set of variables that impact final sort of coffee flavor.
Mm-hmm.
So if we just had to summarize basic methods of fermentation, then we can get a little bit more nuanced. What are those?
So the two basic ways of doing this is you throw pulped coffee and water into a tank and let it ride, or you pulp coffee and let it sit outside of water. So it's just kind of sitting in its own kind of, like if you left fruit on the counter for a couple of weeks and it started to like break down and smell, that banana that you left in your locker for 2 weeks in high school, I think we all done that.
It's actually fermenting.
That's fermented, man. Yeah. So you have two different ways, and the reason why you would choose with water or without water is just kind of dictating by your country of origin. So if you have easy access to water and low water laws, so like you're able to use a lot of wastewater, you might use water. If you don't have access to water, you're not going to use up water to wash your coffee. You're going to dry it or do something like a honey process like Costa Rica does, or mm-hmm. you might do like a longer dry ferment like Kenya does.
Mm.
So it's just kind of dictated by necessity.
Yeah, I definitely originally, I was reading about the different fermentations you see done with Robusta versus Arabica, and one other sort of fermentation method that lives within the dry fermentation realm is when you have a naturally processed coffee, and that's you don't remove the pulp at all, because that certainly ferments as it's left out there in the sun.
It just takes a lot longer.
Yeah. Well, and it's a lot harder to control, too, because in the other methods of fermentation, it's all combined into one big blob of equal fermentation. Like, you're not going to have in a honey process or in a wet process where there's this tank full of coffee, you're not going to have one part of that coffee ferment more than others, as long as it's kept, as long as it's mixed on a regular basis. With a natural process coffee, basically every bean is sort of fermenting a little bit differently. So when you go to a farm and they have beds full or a patio full of naturally processed coffee, some of that coffee may ferment more than other parts of it because the patio is so big or the bed's so big. It's a lot harder to keep things turning, to keep the fermentation equal. Another thing that adds to the difficulty of those fermentations is if the coffee isn't all at the same level of ripeness too, because the sugar content within the mucilage of the coffee will impact how the coffee ferments. So if it's not all equally combined in one big blob of beans and mucilage, then each bean will ferment at a different rate in a naturally processed coffee.
You know, we taste this on a regular basis too when we have natural coffees come into the lab. And more often than not, they're over-fermented. Like, they just taste vinegary, they taste briny. Mm. And that just goes to speak with what Drew's talking about, that it's a lot harder to get a consistent ferment on 9 million little coffee cherries just spread out on raised beds.
Yeah, but when you get a really good naturally processed coffee, it makes us excited, because Christian and I both are fans of a really good naturally processed coffee. They're just hard to find. And they're expensive. Like, the whole reason you would do a naturally processed coffee, maybe it's less expensive. You don't have to have all the milling equipment. You don't have to have the water. You do have to have more space.
You have to have more space. And from what I've learned traveling, it actually is a little bit more expensive because it takes more time to dry that coffee, meaning you can't sell your coffee as quickly, and you do need a ton of space, or you just need to not pick as often, so you actually get less money in the process. Washing allows you to get more coffee sold quicker, especially if you're selling to a cooperative.
Yeah, I think it depends on sort of the infrastructure, because I know in Brazil they do a lot of naturally processed coffee, and in places where water is scarce, like, it is cheaper to do a natural. So it kind of depends on the infrastructure you're running. If you're a small micro lot, it is going to be more expensive to do naturals because it's going to be harder for you to sell them. You got to have a lot of labor to keep things as even as you possibly can, keep things dry. You have to keep naturals dry. You cannot let rain hit them or you're screwed. Can go either way, I think, on the price spectrum, but it's definitely not easy to pull off that style of fermentation and maintain quality. So generally, you have wet fermentation, you have dry fermentation. Let's do subcategories within each one, because I mentioned within dry, there's sort of the just mass combination of pulped cherries, and then there's naturally processed coffees. But in wet fermentation, every country is different, almost.
Kind of. Same basic concept, but we see differences due to kind of volume of coffee process. Like, when you go to Guatemala, there tend to be these really massive washing tanks, like as big as our cupping lab in terms of size. You go to Colombia and there's a lot smaller farm. The biggest difference comes in temperature. So in warmer countries, you put that water on the coffee to kind of buffer it from the heat so it doesn't ferment too quickly, because you don't want to have vinegar coffee, no good. But when you're in a higher altitude, you know, you don't necessarily need that water because it might cause the coffee to ferment slower. So that's where you start to see people either using that dry ferment or in a situation where you would have less access of water. But it's really just that same basic process of taking water in a tank, putting in that coffee, letting it soak, and when the fruit finally releases, you take a big old paddle and you actually stir it up. Or in Guatemala, they have those washing channels that help wash things through, but it's that same basic process. You're seeing people play a little bit with, like, remove the water and then add some more water back in, and what does that do? And stuff like that.
Length of fermentation, double fermentation. We're going to ferment it this way, then we're going to ferment it that way. We're going to do a dry fermentation, then we're going to do a wet fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
Which is all interesting. Like, and there may be something to it. Let's talk a little bit about the project we're working on, to kind of see how different fermentation methods can impact a coffee just at one farm before we go meta. Because I think generally, if you were to move from a wet fermentation to a dry fermentation, those are pretty massively different cup profiles that we all can say, yeah, that's pretty massively mm-hmm. different. But mm-hmm. when we talk about goofing around with when you add water, how you add water, and how that can impact the same coffee just processed two slightly different ways, it may be harder to differentiate. Before we get into that, though, I want to pause for a second because our buddy Mike Johnson asked us question from Johnson Brothers Coffee in Madison. He says, do you agree that bruising the cherries that are going for natural process, these cherries that are going to be used for natural process, can also contribute to uneven or over fermentation?
I would say that would make sense because you're creating an area on that cherry that's less stable, mm-hmm. easier to bruise, so that bacteria can get in there quicker, so it's not going to mm-hmm. go as easily. What did you read up on?
Well, I read that some people do it intentionally.
Interesting.
Yeah, so some people try and be as gentle with their natural process as possible. Others will intentionally agitate the mucilage to create a different fermentation. So I'd say it might contribute to uneven or over fermentation. I think generally you would say because it's starting to break down tissue already, then it would create a faster fermentation. So if you're not super careful with the rest of the fermentation process, over fermentation becomes much more likely. Thanks for the question.
Yeah. We're talking about the project that we're working on. And
yes.
The micro.
Awesome. Yeah. So why don't you just give us a brief overview of this project, which will be coming to stores starting in like two weeks.
Yeah.
Which will be like a day after this launches.
So we reached out to one of our producers that we work with, Aida Batia in El Salvador, and asked her to do from one farm. And it's a farm that I visited with Eric and a couple other guys from the company a few years back. It's a farm called Plan de la Batea. So it's 100% red Bourbon variety that's grown on this farm, at least in the lots we're working with. And we said, well, what happens if you process it like how they process it in Ethiopia? Or how do they process it in Kenya? Let's try that on the coffee. Or how do they process it in Burundi? Let's try that on the coffee. And so we took that same coffee, that same base coffee, and processed it three different ways, all considered quote-unquote wash process. So the Ethiopia style spent more time in water, the Kenya style spent more time out of water, and the Burundi style was kind of like a hybrid between the two. All dried on raised beds, all had the same amount of time, all were picked at the same time, so they're very similar in terms of like their origin track. So that's the basis of the process. I don't want to jump to the conclusion
of the
process yet.
So
we need
to
lead you on a little bit.
Yeah, we're going to get there eventually. Over the next month and a half, 2 months, we're going to release each of these coffees separately. So we're going to release one here in 2 weeks from tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then every 3 weeks after that, we'll release the next one. And then at the end, we're going to release a box set with all three of them together so you can taste them side by side. And this really, along with every other box set we've done, has started as a learning project for us. Like, we've never actually approached one of these box sets with the mentality of like, hey, how do we create a box set that we're going to sell? We sell it, and ideally a lot of people would buy it because that's good for a coffee company. But we've approached them with the desire to learn about, you know, in this case, fermentation. We've done elevation. We've done just mucilage presence on a particular cherry. Elevation. Oh, roast. Roasting one coffee three different ways. And then we've done a couple country sets, too. So we did Colombia and Guatemala. And all those have been fun, and it's been awesome to just kind of taste three coffees side by side, compare and contrast, and draw some conclusions. So we're excited to do that. We're excited to do that with this study. So let's talk about major sort of taste variation within the wet fermentation and the dry fermentation. Like, if you were to kind of sum up the cup profile of a wet fermentation, what would it be?
So it's typically thought that the wet fermentation style is clean. So it's really crisp. It allows for like some brighter, like citric and malic type acidity. So like an orange, like lemon, like a green apple. So kind of crisp, and it leaves less, let's say slightly less body, slightly less mouthfeel, but cleaner. Like you can almost, the way I think about it, you can taste the core of the coffee better. You're not allowing anything else to penetrate in, and it's just pure coffee.
Right, which is not better. It's just, and it's not worse either.
It's just one way of looking at it. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's pretty accurate. I wouldn't add anything to that. So then moving to the wet process, particularly the natural process. So
moving coffee. To the dry process?
Yeah, that's what I meant. Dry.
Dry.
Wet, dry.
Yeah, all good. So dry process coffees obviously change that fermentation style just a little bit. So you start to move from that really clean kind of citric and malic acidity to more lactic type acidity, so kind of back of your tongue. If you eat a really sharp piece of cheddar cheese, that's all lactic, or yogurt's lactic. Kombucha is a good example of malic and lactic fermentation, like in a fruity form. And sometimes that can move too far to acetic. You can also do this in the wash process coffee, by the way, and if you've discovered that,
it's danger zone.
Yeah, you get like this really sweet, almost like you're eating dried fruits, except in coffee. And some people view that as like you're putting other things inside of the raw product. But if you have a really, really good like pulp natural or natural coffee, it can change your life.
Yeah, I read somebody earlier say that natural coffees have less acidity. And I was like, no, that's actually not true. Like, it's just a more rounded acidity and a different kind of acidity.
Comments like that make me want to have like a pocket pH meter and be like, let me show you.
It's just different. It's not citric. Okay. It's not malic. And maybe citric and malic in a natural, but you're also just going to get different kinds of acidity. So much of flavor and mouthfeel is acidity more than anything else, because acidity is a sensation. It's not like a taste. Which you can go back and listen to our Flavor Notes acidity episode to get more information on how the different kinds of, how you perceive the different kinds of acidity and where you might, what kind of coffees you might expect to find those acidity types in. All right. So we've talked about what fermentation is, why you might ferment coffee, methods of fermentation, wet and dry, and then some of the more country-specific methods of fermentation, and then how it impacts flavor.
Let's talk about good fermentation and bad fermentation.
Sure, and then I have one other thing I want to do before we close out. Let's do that.
Sure. Then. Imagine that you're a cupper down at Origin, and you go through this table, and all of a sudden you're like, whoa, what's this funky thing? Like, this has this weird tropical flavor. And someone tells you it's 100% washed coffee. You're like, excuse me? This is a natural, right?
Yeah, I know what these things are supposed to taste like.
Yeah, I know what these things are supposed to taste like. And really, if you're following the science of pulping coffee, unless you do something by accident or you do something kind of, I'm not going to say wrong because I can't think of another word right now. It should be fairly consistent the way it tastes. So every once in a while, someone would go through and be like, oh, we bought in this wash process coffee, but it tastes like a natural. And to me, I'm just thinking, this is kind of a weird one-off mistake coffee that tastes pretty good. I'm not going to deny that it doesn't taste good, because I've been in a scenario where, like, this actually is a pretty good coffee.
Yeah.
But it's not repeatable and it's not consistent. And things like that bother me, especially if you get a larger lot of coffee. It's not going to be consistent through your run. If you're intentionally doing the same thing to every single product or every single batch of coffee coming in and all of it tastes the same, great. That means you're intentionally using your variables. But accidental fermentation is no good. And especially when it starts to turn into balsamic-y, vinegary, savory, umami notes, like
it's not what you want in your coffee.
No. Chocolate-covered balsamic vinegar bites. Ugh. Not for me.
I mean, ultimately, the cup wins, right? That's what we say at Stone Creek. So if it is good coffee, that's fine. But to Christian's point, you may have one lot. If you bought, you know, a larger pot of coffee, and then you have one processing lot versus another one, they're supposed to be processed the same way. They're supposed to taste the same way. But one was really fruity because the fermentation went slightly wonky. You may like that, but you need that coffee to taste the same at the start of when you run it for the customers as it does at the end. Otherwise, somebody's going to go, I had this and I loved it, and then I had it again and it was odd.
Mm-hmm.
Or I had it and it was fruity and I really loved it, and then I came back and it wasn't as fruity. So, Consistency is king in coffee, I think. Or queen. All right, so covering that, let's talk a little bit about fermentation as a fad. Because when we talk about barrel aging things, fermenting things also is kind of in that really popular sphere of well, it's popular.
It's super popular, especially with the younger kids.
Like us.
Like our millennial generation. We seem to be into, it's like, you saw the Portlandia episode, We Can Pickle That?
No, but I need to watch
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a little segment called We Can Pickle That.
And that's very great.
It's the same guys that did the Pretty Bird on it. The same two characters.
Yeah.
It's really popular. I'm actually considering making my own kombucha later this week. I'm going to be brewing some beer later this week, too. It's cool because you're kind of taking ingredients that you already have around. And you can change them and make them yourself. My girlfriend and I tried to make pickles for her dad for Christmas, and they failed, like sour pickles, because we let too much chlorine in the water, but whatever. It's really interesting, really kind of fatty. Fad.
Oh, yeah.
F-A-D, not fatty, but fatty. I don't know where it's going to take us in terms of coffee. Yeah. Like, there are people that are doing, like, these fermentation experiments like we're doing. And there are other folks that are doing these weird, like, off-the-wall, like, here's this malic fermentation, here's this lactic fermentation. And they're paying a lot of money for these coffees.
A lot of money for these coffees. It's risky. You can kind of get away with it if you're a one-shop place that buys two bags of coffee. You know, your investment's not that big, but, you know, the smallest lot of coffee that we buy to sell to our customers because of our size is like 6 bags. So that's talking about a $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 investment for every lot of coffee we buy. And if that goes bad, then we eat thousands of dollars. So we don't want to do that. Let's talk, though, about what we're seeing, because what we're seeing is people... just playing around with how they can make coffee tastes, like, which is funny to me. For an industry that hates adding things to coffee, we're really getting into adding things to coffee. Like, in this case, it's yeast, right? I mean, we've seen people add all kinds of beer yeast and wine yeast.
So our friend Giorgio down in Guatemala is part of a cheese factory as well. There's a cheese factory right next to the farm. He's like, yeah, I took some yogurt yeast or yogurt bacteria, and we fermented the coffee with them. Like, that's cool. The issue right now, and I'm just going to be really blunt, the issue with people trying to experiment with this is that they're not brewers. They don't think this thing through, and the changes that they're trying to add things into, like, you see people adding Saison yeast, ale yeast, beer yeast, champagne yeast, all this other stuff, which is really cool in concept, but you need to think about it like a scientist would. Or a brewer would, and you need to think about like the strength of the natural bacteria and how they affect. Because most of what we tasted haven't really tasted that different than the core coffee.
Yeah, it's like coffee.
There's all that wild yeast on there. They're probably not taking that into consideration, or maybe I'm just making assumptions that they're doing all this and their work isn't showing. But it's curious. It's curious.
So we're gonna pause there. We're gonna go because I have absorbed food science through my wife, and Christian has absorbed food science through himself. And so we're going to talk about yeast for just a second. People are playing with different yeasts in their fermentation, but you mentioned wild yeast, and I think this is super important, is that, like, generally speaking, if you have a yeast-heavy environment, wild yeast is always going to win out because it's strong, it's there, it's adapted to the environment, where so often, even in local baking, like if we're baking in Milwaukee, we can use a sourdough that's made through yeast naturally from the environment, or we can use like the active dry yeast you get in the packet. And every single day you'll get a better product with a sourdough that's made locally versus that artificial yeast you're using. Just because like the robustness, if I can use that word, of the local yeast like grown in a natural environment will just destroy the quality of product you can get through using really what is kind of an artificial yeast product.
I have heard that like sourdoughs, if you have them from all over the country or even all over the world, every single one will taste slightly different.
That's
because
true.
There is a different yeast behind it. Segue that back to coffee. I don't know if you're ready to do that.
I am.
Let's segue
with that yeast information.
With that yeast information, segue that back to coffee. I really believe, and the more that I see this, the more that I believe it, that a lot of the flavor that happens in the fermentation in coffee is because of the indigenous yeast to that area, to the wild yeast that's on that farm, and you can't really replicate that anywhere else. So when you have a really awesome micro lot, it might have a little bit to do with the specific terroir, or the day, or the lot that it grew, or that this one had a little bit more sun this year, so it cupped a little bit better. But push comes to shove, the best farms may just be because they have the best wild yeast product. And consistently, the same farms are placing a cup of excellence. Consistently, like you see, average better coffee from some farms than other farms. And it could be due to processing, it could be due to picking, it could be due to growing, it could be due to soil fertilization. All these things matter. But I think the biggest thing that we don't consider at large is that this yeast, these wild organisms, really do impact that final cup. Mm-hmm. And when you find a really good farm, like I just want to go start a micro lab, like a small organism or small organisms lab down in Central America, and just study this stuff and really understand like what's making that coffee taste awesome. And could I like throw a bacteria grenade at another farm and inoculate them with better yeast?
Maybe.
Like these things pop in my head. Yeah. Like how can I help people grow coffee better?
I mean, and it's interesting as one variable of many. Like, so yeast absolutely will impact the fermentation, which impacts the flavor. But if we were to just walk through every single thing that impacts that we know impacts the final cup profile, you know, it starts with soil composition. It's the variety of coffee tree that's growing. It's rainfall. It's sun duration. It's the ripeness level that the coffee is picked at. It's how long that coffee sits before it's processed. It's all of the processing methods. It's the drying time. It's the time it sits after it's dried before it comes over here. It's how we roast it. It's how long it sits after it's roasted. It's how it's ground. It's the water you use. It's how it's brewed. Like all these things. So we're talking about just a tiny little thing, but each variable in coffee, and this is why coffee is so dang hard to do really, really well, is because each of those variables you can actually mess up and ruin the coffee. Like, you can make tweaks along the way if you're super good and you understand things really well, how to make it, a you know, good, or how to make it a little bit different from the next cup, but you can also ruin it. And so when you take all of that in perspective, we talk about fermentation, which is fun to geek out about, but, like, it's one of those things where I'm sort of less concerned with it, like, as we try and move Stone Creek forward. We want to learn about it and understand how we can get good coffee year in and year out. But if we, I'm less concerned with playing around with like beer yeast types than just getting good coffee on every single one of those variables. Because it's hard enough as it is.
I agree. Well said.
All right, cool.
That's a good summary statement right there.
We'll wrap there. Next time, we will actually talk about, give some tips for baristas. Like if you're getting into coffee, how can I be a good barista? Like what does that mean? If you were to take all the content from the previous many episodes we've done, you could basically say this is, I'm pretty sure, is how to be a good barista, but we're going to try and condense that stuff for you to give tips for the new barista. Sorry we didn't talk about it today, but we wanted to have this episode done when we launch our first coffee from that fermentation set. And that will be out January
12th, I believe.
Yep, that's the 12th.
Confirmed.
January 12th, so you can grab that online at stonecreekcoffee.com or in our cafes. After you sign off from here, you can go over to iTunes and leave us a review. That would be swell. Or if you're binging, just go to stonecreekcoffee.com where we have all 40-some episodes we've done so far. If you have a particular topic you'd like us to talk about, send us an email, podcast@stonecreekcoffee.com, or you can tweet at us at Stone Creek Coffee. You know, we want to answer your questions. Even if you don't have like a podcast type question, you can email us. Christian's gotten together with several people who just want to talk about coffee, how to grow coffee, how to brew coffee better, because it's what we're passionate about. So you can do that. Till next time, we are geeks.
And we are talking coffee.
See ya.